She said she'd love me for eternity, but managed to reduce it to 8 months for good behaviour. She said we fitted like a hand in a glove, but then the hot weather came and such accessories weren't needed. She said the future was ours, but the house deeds were made out in her name. She said I was the only one who understood her completely. And then she left me and said she knew I'd understand completely. It's a strange thing about marriage statistics today, in spite of the fact that, as we all know, more and more marriages are breaking up. It seems that nevertheless more and more people want to get married. You'd have thought by now disillusionment would have set in, wouldn't you? You'd have thought people would be giving up the whole idea of commitment to a single partner of the opposite sex, but no. As Dr. Johnson once commented when he heard that a widower friend of his was getting remarried, "Alas," he said, "the triumph of hope over experience." But there seem many people who are determined to express that same triumph. That, no doubt, is one reason the Valentine's Day industry seems to be becoming more and more profitable. Everywhere, people are looking for that magical romance which will turn grey to gold, which will fill the sky with stars. Love changes everything, says the pop song. Even though they know the chance of finding this magical romance are small, and that the chance of it lasting more than 5 minutes are even smaller, yet the fantasy remains. Maybe we can't buy love, but we can certainly buy a Valentine's card. In the hope of love, in the hope that maybe one day Cupid's arrow will find its mark in our heart. Why is it, do you think, that true love seems to be so elusive and so short-lived? I've got a suggestion to make to you on that score tonight. I reckon it's all tied up with a fundamental change in our understanding of the word love. Because if you think about it, love is a word that is seriously overused in our vocabulary, isn't it? It has to serve for a huge range of human responses. You can use it as food. I love bananas. You can use it of your pets. I love my dog. You can use it of people. I love my wife. But all these loves are not of the same type, are they? That was the mistake Joe was making, wasn't it, in the film strip? He treated loving people as if it was the same as loving objects. But surely they're not the same kind of love, are they? In ancient Greece, they weren't quite so confused about this, for their language wasn't so imprecise. They had several different words for love, and each of them had a much narrower range of meaning than our single word love does. I suspect, you know, the reason so many people are finding love elusive today is because they have confused at least two of those Greek words, so emphasizing one that they've lost sight of the other. These are the two particular words I've got in mind. You might have heard of at least the first one. It's predictably one of the few Greek words that everybody in the 20th century knows. Eros. But that's only one of the words the Greeks used for what we would call love. There's another one. Agape. Let me explain Eros to you first. Eros is the word of sexual desire. Well, everybody knows that. It's a powerful, explosive, intoxicating love, is Eros. But it is notoriously fragile, notoriously volatile. It's unpredictable, for a start. Cupid seems to be a very mischievous imp, and he fires his arrows of desire in a way that sometimes seems hopelessly random. That's why we say, we fell in love. almost as if it was an unexpected thing, an accident. Like you might say, you fell into a hole. And because it's so unexpected and accidental, it is also fickle. For suddenly as it arrives, it can sometimes evaporate. We fell in love, we fell out of love again. That's how we seem to use the vocabulary of love in the 20th century, isn't it? And when we do so, we prove that it's eros we're talking about. You see, eros depends for its power on the attractiveness of the loved one. It's a kind of tribute, really. When you say, I love someone in the eros sense, what you really mean is, I think you've got a beautiful body. Or perhaps, in a more sophisticated and romantic way, I think you have a lovely personality. Eros is a love, as we say in the 1980s, which needs to be turned on. But unfortunately, it can equally easily be turned off. Physical attractiveness doesn't last, as number one found out. The years pass, and like a car gets a bit sagging in the suspension, so does number two. Maybe it's time to trade in for a new model. Looks don't last. In fact, personality isn't always what it's cracked up to be either. Even the nicest personality can prove to be less congenial than you thought it was going to be when you have to live with it 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Now, eros depends for its power on the attractiveness of the loved one. And that's one of the reasons it's unreliable. Fickle. It's a passion, you see, not a virtue. Eros doesn't have any ethical quality to it. It's a feeling, it's a drive, it's a desire. It's a word that expresses emotional dependency or sexual lust, even. It's a word very much taken up with demanding rather than giving. It can be an insanely jealous love. It can be an outrageously cruel love for that reason. For I love you in the eros sense means I need you, I want you. And that's why, as everybody knows, money can buy eros. Down in Soho, there is a sex industry exploiting that very market. For it's the business of economics to satisfy demand. And eros is a very demanding love. Now, I don't know how you feel about it, but unfortunately, I feel the situation of the 1980s is that when people talk about love between the sexes, it is eros that they usually have principally in mind. It may be that passionate romance we read about in a Mills Boone's novel. It may be those steamy sexual gymnastics we witnessed in some X-rated movie. But wherever our fantasy came from, it's eros we're after. And that's why we're so prone to disappointment, you see. Because, as we said at the beginning, eros is fragile, vulnerable, a vapor of the emotions, a sentimental virus. You catch it, you recover from it. You fall into it, you fall out of it. It's not the sort of thing you can depend upon. Now, as I say, I want to suggest to you tonight there is an alternative. A different kind of love altogether. Let me direct your attention to a passage in the Bible that talks about it. It's quite a famous passage. In fact, many of you, I expect, had it read at your weddings. It's Paul's great hymn to love, 1 Corinthians 13. Just notice how he describes love. Love is patient, he says. Love is kind. It does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud, it is not rude, it is not self-seeking, it is not easily angered, It keeps no record of wrongs. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. Now, you see, conditioned by our 20th century culture, reading a chapter like that, which so often mentions the word love, inevitably a whole host of basically sentimental associations leap into our mind. It's very easy for us to jump to the conclusion that Paul is here talking about a way of feeling about other people. Because that's how conventionally we use the vocabulary of love. It's a way we feel. But if you look carefully at that description, you will quickly see that Paul is in fact not talking about a way of feeling at all. Oh, I'm not saying there's no element of affection or warmth in his use of the word, but that isn't primarily what's in his mind, is it? All these qualities which he predicates of love are not feelings. They're not emotions. They're ways of behaving towards other people. Aren't they? Do you notice that? Patience, kindness. No pride, no envy, no boasting, no rudeness, no self-seeking, no anger. Paul isn't here talking about a way of feeling, but a way of behaving. How does love behave when it's irritated? It's patient and kind. How does love behave when it comes in second? It doesn't envy. How does love behave when it comes in first? It doesn't boast. How does love behave when it's bored? It isn't rude. How does love behave when it's overlooked? It isn't self-seeking. How does love behave when it's hurt? It isn't easily angered. How does love behave when it's cheated? It keeps no record of wrongs. See, we're not talking here about a passion. We're talking about a moral virtue. And that is because Paul is here not using the Greek word eros. He's using a different word altogether. Agape. Down through the years, Bible translators have tried their hardest to find some way to reproduce this vital choice of vocabulary on the apostle's part. When Jerome worked on the Latin Vulgate, he avoided the obvious Latin word for love, amor, because it too had emotional rather than moral associations. And he rendered agape, therefore, by the Latin word caritas. And Wycliffe, in his English version, followed the Vulgate's lead in that, and so translated 1 Corinthians 13 with the word charity. Charity is patient. Charity is kind. Those of you who are familiar with the old authorized version of the Bible will remember. Unfortunately, today, charity has become limited also. It largely has to do with collecting money for good causes, doesn't it? So our translators have wisely dropped charity from 1 Corinthians 13, but unfortunately that leaves us with no rendering for agape that really corresponds to Paul's original word at all. We just have to use this overused word, love, again. And so we open ourselves to confusion. But this evening, I want you to really get your minds around the fact that when Paul, and indeed when the whole of the Bible, uses the word love, it doesn't have eros in mind. Do you know the word eros never occurs in the entire New Testament? Once? That isn't the New Testament's idea of love. Paul is talking here about a love that lasts. Do you see what he says about it? It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. He can talk about it in that way because it's not a passion. In the way that eros is. Now, agape is a very special kind of love. Unfortunately for us, the Bible has given us a most beautiful illustration of it. Once you've grasped the illustration of agape love the Bible gives us, then I doubt whether you'll be left in any question at all about the superiority of this kind of love. This is how we know what agape is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. God demonstrates his agape for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. See, this love, unlike eros, is dependable. Shakespeare said, "Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds," in his famous sonnet. Well, he'd have done better to say, "Love is not agape which alters when it alteration finds," because it's eros you're talking about. It's all too vulnerable to alteration. But no, not agape. It's dependable because it's not dependent on the attractiveness of the loved one. You see, it wasn't the case that Jesus fell in love with us. It wasn't that he looked down from heaven and saw what wonderfully attractive people we were and thought, "Wow, I must have them." What he saw when he looked down from heaven were a bunch of sinners. A bunch of people who were hateful and wicked. He didn't find anything attractive in us at all. For God finds nothing commendable or attractive in sin. Yet, while we were sinners, he died for us. That's how God demonstrates his agape for us, you see. We didn't win his love. He gave it. And because it's that kind of love, a love which isn't extracted, isn't a tribute to the beauty or the attractiveness or the loveliness of the object, but which rather finds its root in the heart of the lover, because it's that kind of love, it's a love which God is able to promise. Now, many people have difficulties with the Christian marriage service for this reason, don't they? The vicar or the minister stands in front of you and he says, "Do you promise to love this person?" More and more people I find when we're going through the marriage vows these days before a marriage service ask questions about that. How can I promise to love someone? I mean, I don't know how I'm going to feel in 10 years' time. You see, we give ourselves away. It's not agape love we're talking about, is it? It's eros love. I don't know how I'm going to feel in 10 years' time. Of course you can't promise about how you're going to feel, but agape love isn't about how you're going to feel, it's how you're going to act. What we promise is how we're going to behave towards that other person. Not just in 10 years' time, but in 20 years' time, and in 30 years' time, until death us do part. I sometimes heard those words, "I will," you know, expressed in rather strange ways at marriage services. I've heard everything from resign surrender, "I will," to stupefied amazement, "I will?" But how we ought to say it, of course, is with some determination in our voices. "I will." It's a promise. It's a promise we can make if we're talking about agape love. It's a promise which God does make to us. A promise not about how he feels, but how he intends to act. A generous love. Not a demanding love. A love the nature of which is to give rather than to take. What does it say? "He laid down his life for us." Agape, you see, is the love money can never buy. For it is a love that can never be sold, only given. God offers us such love in Jesus. That's the message of the New Testament. We had never loved him in that way. For all his goodness, we had only gone our own way, selfishly pursuing our own goals, ignoring him. If God was in our lives at all, we only treated him like some kind of object, not a person, not someone with claims upon us, not someone we could hurt, Indeed, he could have, in all justice, have told us to go to hell. Such was the abuse that we demonstrated towards him. But he didn't. He loved us and sent his son to die for us. That is the great discovery. That was Joe's discovery. That's what changed the world for Joe. The song is right. Love does change everything, but not eros. Agape. The love of God in Christ changes everything. That's what Joe found. For there on that cross, we see the pain of unrequited love, the agony that tears the heart of this God who loves sinners and pays the price for loving them. That cross is the kiss that he offers to us, ungrateful and undeserving sinners. When someone says, "I love you," it demands a response, doesn't it? It's very hard to turn your back and walk away from someone when they've said something as shattering as that. In the cross, God says, "I love you." So he demands a response of us. It's possible to turn our backs on that cross, to walk away from it. But what he wants, what he longs for, is that we should respond to his initiative of love. He longs that we should let go of that futile quest for self-gratification, which is what eros is all about, and allow him to teach us the higher love. The deeper love, the eternal love, the divine love. Christians are people who've done just that. They are people who've responded to the love of God and who are trying to love in the same way too, sacrificially rather than selfishly, perseveringly rather than temperamentally. Oh, I don't claim that Christians always succeed. You'll no doubt be able to pick a few holes in the lives of any of the Christians you know. They wouldn't pretend to be perfect. But daily Christians are people who are asking God to live in them and help them by the power of Jesus' Spirit to demonstrate that love which he has first showed to them. And God offers us that love tonight. He offers it for our relationships, for our marriages. But more than that, he offers it for our hearts. He offers it to us in Jesus. What was it Paul said about love? Patient and kind. Doesn't envy, doesn't boast. But you see, that's just a description of Jesus, isn't it? He was patient. He was kind. Jesus didn't envy. Jesus didn't boast. Jesus wasn't proud. Jesus wasn't rude or self-seeking. He wasn't easily angered. He kept no record of wrongs. He always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. He never fails. Jesus was love personified. A new commandment I give to you, he says, that you love one another as I have loved you. When we invite Jesus Christ into our lives, into our marriages, into our homes, into our hearts, we invite love. We shall find that love will begin to flower as he takes up residence there. and starts the process of change. Yes, love changes everything. Let's pray together.